Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Nicholas Fox Weber. He has been the executive director of the Yosef and Ani Albers Foundation and founder of Le Corsa, a nonprofit arts, education, and medical organization in Senegal. And we're talking about his new book, I Bauhaus, the iPhone as the embodiment of Bauhaus ideals and design. Nick, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Pleasure for me, Mark.
I want to say this to the audience. I bought this book because I thought the title, there is no two things that I would have put together, the iPhone and the Bauhaus, which I dearly love. I would never have put those two together. I was skeptical. I read this book. I'm a believer in the words of the monkeys. This is a fascinating book, and I want to also mention that we can't do the book justice because it's your writing that really makes this book swing. And I strongly recommend that listeners pick up the book and delve into it because it's a really enjoyable book.
I can't thank you enough.
Now, I got to ask you, how did you come up with this idea?
I mentioned to a friend who also... let me step back. I knew Annie and Joseph Albers, which was...
We're going to talk about that because there's a great section in this book about them.
In my life. And I knew what their tastes were. I was always very aware of them. And one day I was just holding my iPhone and I thought, my God, the Alberses would have loved this. It's simple, compact, well executed. They love their Sony television. They love their Polaroid SX70 camera. They often said, good machinery is better than bad art. And I found myself thinking that the iPhone just would have appealed to them. I mentioned this at lunch with a friend named John Eastman maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And he said, write a book about it, Nick. And then, as friends sometimes do, he said, it'll be more interesting than the book you wrote about Freud and the painter Luca Signorelli. I could have, done without the negative boost to the other subject, but there I was. And I began to think about it, started doing some research, and what had been a hunch ended up having a great deal of history behind it.
Right. It really did. It's history of the Bauhaus. It's history of the Albers and people like Paul Klee. It's history of Steve Jobs. It's history of the Apple and iPhone. And it's all put together in a really sort of interesting and it's a delightful read is the word I can say. For people in the listening audience who aren't that familiar with the Bauhaus, let's quickly describe why the Bauhaus is so significant.
Well, Mark, the Bauhaus was a school created in 1919. It lasted until 1933 in three different locations in Germany. It was an international design school where people came from different countries with various skills in metalwork, carpentry, weaving, painting, and so on. And the idea was that everyone would work together as people had centuries earlier in the construction of Gothic cathedrals. The idea was a community effort, no emphasis on the self, not on fame, not on the glitz around an artist's name, but really a community effort at design. And what happened at the Bauhaus was that the very dynamic founder of the school, the architect Walter Gropius, attracted brilliant artists there.
Oh,
among them, you mentioned Paul Klee, Wassily Kandinsky, and many others.
It's amazing how, from almost the very start, the school became so influential.
It began to attract people, as you say, from the moment that it started. It had a very appealing, short, concise, beautiful brochure describing the school. There was a modernist rendition of a Gothic cathedral by the American artist Feininger on the cover, and a short, attractive statement by Walter Gropius. And so people wanted to be there. After World War I, there was a quest for the new. The 20s were a lively time period. And people wanted to change the appearance of everything. And design was fundamental.
And it wasn't just design. Let's talk about this for a minute, because there really is a Bauhaus ideal. And it's design that's, first of all, enjoyed by a large public. To summarize, it would be plain, trim, clean, and aesthetic. That's from your book. And all those things, and you find the embodiment of them in the iPhone.
Well, you just came up with the perfect adjectives for what the Bauhaus values were, and they're there in the name of the school itself. Bauhaus was an invented word, not the usual multisyllabic German word about building, but the simplest way of saying house for building. And I did make a jump to the name iPhone.
Yep.
We're all used to iPad, iPhone, iPod, but those names didn't exist in any language prior to their having been invented specifically for the objects that they describe. So you have an invented name, which is startling and interesting, a concise name, and one that describes the object as well. An iPhone is a phone. But then there's that mystery of the little I. People debate what it's for, information, intelligence. But whatever it is, it takes us in a new way of thinking. And part of the Bauhaus spirit is form following function.
Right.
And that's an essential element. The beauty of whiteness, which is implicit in the objects that we're discussing, sort of trim, clean, and mean.
We should talk about, there's so much to talk about in this book. You write that Jobs resembled Walter Gropius, but they were completely different people, but they both used language in a way consistent with their products. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, both of these men spoke in very clear language, not academic language, not language that made their listeners feel stupid, but on the contrary, language that was persuasive. And I became very involved in a talk that Steve Jobs gave at the Aspen Design Institute, which in a way was a hotbed of Bauhaus spirit in Colorado. And speaking there, Steve Jobs spoke in a way that brought his audience in. He neither spoke down to people, nor did he speak in a way that others couldn't follow. And both of these men had a personal appeal, which helped them launch what it was that they believed in. They also spoke with total conviction. When Gropius discussed modernism, when he talked about the power of non-ornamental architecture, straightforward steel struts, and so on, he was convincing. He had an electric quality. And Steve Jobs, when we listen to him, we're aware that he just had that ability to bring you in.
Jobs never mentioned Bauhaus teachings, though, did he, in any of his speeches?
No. It's strange because books say that he talked specifically about the Bauhaus in that lecture in Aspen. And for many years, no one could find a recording of the lecture. I heard it. A tape was found just perhaps 5 years ago. And he never spoke about the Bauhaus per se, never used the word. He was known to love the Bauhaus. People who knew him said that he was quite obsessed with the school in a personal way. There was even an early love interest of his who said that she could no longer have a partnership with him, more interested in the Bauhaus than in her. And so he definitely was familiar with the school, even if he didn't name it.
He was influenced by some things that we do know about All One Farm and Zen. And when I think about Zen, this is sort of a weird thing to say. Zen strikes me as sort of the Bauhaus of religion.
Completely. Because there's this emphasis on restraint, paring something down, letting go of a lot of complexity.
Right.
When we think of the rock gardens of Kyoto, the use of empty space and the quiet is the equivalent in many ways of Bauhaus ideals and of Steve Jobs' ideals.
Talk about All One Farm, too, because that was very special to Jobs.
Well, All One Farm was essentially a farm, a vast apple orchard, where Steve Jobs worked after being at Reed College, not graduating, decided that he wanted something else to do. People use the terms like hippie commune, which seem a bit passé at the moment, but that's where Steve Jobs was immensely happy. And after working at the farm, he did come up with the name of Apple for his company. And to me, that choice of name is absolutely perfect and also in keeping with Bauhaus values. An apple is a terrific package, beautifully designed as a package when we think of it, with its skin wrapped around it, holding in that succulent, nourishing flesh. It's got a stem just where you want it for convenience, for holding it. Not that it's the reason that an apple has a stem there, but it's one of the things that makes it such a friendly object. And then you have the seeds at the core. And the universality of the form of the apple is something that became of enormous interest to me because it translates to every language, every culture. It's not fussy, and it provides a very good feeling, a feeling of fullness.
One of the joys of your book are these digressions that you take in different essays, and you have a great essay on the apple. You write, you know, originally that apple had all this rainbow color in it, and that was never as visually satisfying as just the plain apple that's on my phone right now that's sitting here right in front of me.
I couldn't agree more. For me, the apple with a thick rainbow of stripes on it is a bit garish.
Yeah,
it just doesn't do it.
It also has a bite out of it. And talk about that and the significance of that.
Well, the bite has been much discussed, and there was a theory that it was a reference to the great early computer scientist who, Alan
Turing.
Name is eluding.
Is it?
Alan Turing.
Right.
And that it was a reference to his suicide.
Right.
When convicted of homosexuality, and I hate the word convicted, but it's at a time when it was a crime in England, and threatened with jail, he took a bite out of an apple laced with cyanide. But as much as we can understand it, the bite out of the apple used by Apple Computer Company is not a reference to Alan Turing. But in fact, Steve Jobs was always a little bit ambiguous on the subject. He never said there's one reason. At one point, it was suggested that it's to differentiate the apple from a cherry, because otherwise the form would seem the same, but you can't take a bite out of a cherry. But I think something quite different. To me, the essence of the association of an apple is the story of Adam and Eve.
Yes.
And the moment of taking the bite out of the apple is the moment of being forced to flee paradise, or being exiled from paradise, but it's also a way of entering another form of paradise, because that bite out of the apple means sex. It means maybe breaking some of the rules, but it opens the door to wonderful things in life. And even though it's considered to be sin as such, the bite out of the apple is also a route to adventure, newness, the unexpected.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Nicholas Fox Weber. He's been the executive director of the Yosef and Ani Albers Foundation and founder of Le Corsa, a nonprofit arts, education, and medical organization in Senegal. And we're talking about his new book, which is just one of the most interesting books about design and meaning, iBauhaus, the iPhone as the embodiment of Bauhaus ideals and design. When we talk about Bauhaus ideals, it went right down to typography and typefaces. And one of the type designers that you mentioned in the book is, and I'm going to mispronounce this, so I apologize, Jan Schicholt.
Jan Schicholt.
Schicholt. The book itself is printed in that typeface, isn't it?
That was a wonderful coincidence. Jan Schicholt.
I don't think that was a coincidence.
Well, I do. I tried to put it. Knopf always puts in the note about the type, and I tried to point out the relationship. Well, you may be right. Perhaps it was not a coincidence.
It was an artistic choice.
It was a great choice. Schicholt was a Czechoslovakian-born designer who knew Joseph Albers. These two men had a great deal in common in their vision, and Schicholt invented an elegant typeface called Sabone, and Albers felt very strongly that certain modern typefaces, which do not have a serif, the little tail that gets added to parts of a letter, that certain modern typefaces like Helvetica or Tempo are very difficult to read, that the serif is what enables the eye to move along from letter to letter. It makes things more legible. And Albers admired Schicholt's use of Sabone, and he admired Schicholt's graphic layout, which was extremely elegant.
One of the pleasures of this book, of many, is the section on Joseph and Ani Albers, who you got to know while they were living. And I want to talk about them a bit, because for me, reading that section really made it sort of made the Bauhaus teachings come alive in a step further than I'd known up until that point. Where were they living when you got to know them?
First of all, Mark, I have to say it is such a pleasure as a writer to hear the things that you're saying, because naturally one gets reviews. Not everyone sees things as you do. And I'm talking about you, Mark. I'm not talking about me in this case. And I felt so lucky in experiencing Bauhaus values through the Albers, and I do think that they were a way into the real values of
Absolutely.
The school, which was more than just a design or a moment in history, but an approach to living, an honesty and a modesty. I met them when they were living in Orange, Connecticut. When I was taken to meet them the first time, knowing that they had been masters at the Bauhaus, both of them, I thought that I would arrive at a flat-roofed, starkly modern, white, streamlined house, something that looked like the Bauhaus itself. And to my astonishment, I arrived at the most typical American-raised ranch, covered in not very attractive shingles that were sort of the color of very creamy coffee. There was no foundation planting in front, so you had it sitting honestly on concrete, but in a way that was unusual. And even the sight of their house made me aware that my concept of Bauhaus was wrong, because the Bauhaus isn't just about one style. It's about living in a way that enables you to have an extremely rich and creative life. And that's because you depend on simple, appealing, functional forms that become a stage for living and a vehicle for living. And Annie and Joseph were striking from the moment that I met them, very simply dressed, but elegantly dressed. You knew that appearance was a concern for them, but it wasn't a matter of vanity, foppishness, or
too much
style. Certainly not a matter of flaunting wealth. It was a matter of wearing a shirt that reflected the qualities of cotton, or even, as Annie Albers would say, drip dry, which she thought was a beautiful concept. And they wore modest colors. Both had very neat gray hair. They were strikingly serene and sure of themselves without being arrogant.
The interior decoration of their house, which you describe well, often objects had multi-purposes, so that something that would serve as a nightstand would also serve as something else. And everything was about design and usefulness.
Completely. Next to her bed, Annie had a three-tier serving cart on wheels, quite unattractive by most standards, a typical piece of office equipment. But as you say, it was a night table. It was also a place where she could keep art supplies, and a place where she and Joseph had their one television, which was a small, portable Sony TV, the design of which they greatly admired.
their passions was what really meant a lot to me. Annie was passionate about Tupperware, for instance, which makes perfect sense with her Bauhaus background. And when I read that in the book, I was just sort of tickled because, as you write at another point, Steve Jobs saw a Cuisinart, and that came out from that came his idea for the Apple computer, the packaging of the Apple computer.
Absolutely. Annie used to like to go to the department store Sears Roebuck. and when she was in a wheelchair, my wife would wheel her around, and Annie would do what she called treasure hunting. And instead of being one of those people who needed to buy an expensive object or something for status, she could pick up a simple Tupperware container and say, "This is what we were trying to do at the Bauhaus," because it was a good use of materials, synthetic, easy to clean, and very satisfying to her.
What was also fascinating was hearing them talk about contemporary and modern art. As you write, Joseph thought that rigor and visual neatness were imperative to great art, but they had a deep appreciation for a wide range of art, and not stuff that necessarily played into the Bauhaus ideals.
Annie and Joseph appreciated quality of every style. So
Joseph, for
example, worshipped the artist Piero della Francesca, an early Renaissance painter who had the very qualities that you mentioned, rigor and discipline, and at the same time, a supreme sense of beauty. Joseph and I talked about an 18th century German Rococo architect named Balthasar Neumann, and I think he was quite surprised that I was a graduate student at Yale, 60 years his junior, that I knew the work of this architect and loved it because of its beautiful creation of space and the great skill in its plaster work. And Joseph loved it also, whereas he did not like most of the other artists who would have been in the expensive art auction house catalogs. He just found that American abstract expressionism was often too personal, and by his standards, not sufficiently about something universal. Both Joseph and Annie loved universality in the sense that color has universal appeal. Line can be appreciated universally. But if we take an example of an artist, well-known artist like Francis Bacon, whose work Joseph specifically disdained, we have an artist who is revealing a great deal of his own personal suffering. Many of us think that's just fine in art. For Annie and Joseph, it was not. Huh. They did not feel that personal suffering, private experience, private sexual issues should be the subject of an artwork. They preferred artwork which could speak in all languages and address something that was less personal to specific individuals.
We're almost out of time, and we could be talking about this book for hours, but one of the other things you learned through them were about the other Bauhauslers, like Paul Klee, and what their private lives were like, what they were like from day to day. And the Albers really offered a tremendous depth of insight into what it was like to be at the Bauhaus.
And Mark, I was so privileged in the early 70s to know these people. And I remember that every time I left their house, when I was out of visual distance, I would pull my car over to the side of the road and write notes about what they had said.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because imagine getting to hear about the birthday party that Annie Albers orchestrated for Paul Klee so that he would receive his gifts from above, from a Junker small open
cockpit. Don't give away any more details. People need to read the book.
Ah, thank you.
That's a wild story, by the way. I'm going to say that's one of the greatest stories I've ever read about the Bauhaus. We're out of time. My guest tonight has been Nicholas Fox Weber. He has been the executive director of the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation and the founder of Le Corsa, a nonprofit arts, education, and medical organization in Senegal. But we've been talking about his new book, I Bauhaus, the iPhone as the embodiment of Bauhaus ideals and design. Nick, it's been a real pleasure.
Enormous pleasure for me, Mark. I can't thank you enough.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.